This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. Our study leader is Brother Roger Lewis of New Zealand. This is session 13, the Sheba Tarshish Group, Friends or Foes to Gog. Brother Roger.
Well, what I think we might do this afternoon is as follows. In this session on the Sheba Tarshish group, what I'm going to do is spend a little bit of time, in fact, identifying Tarshish. And the main reason for that is that the points of identification for Tarshish aren't really going to be plotted on a map. They're going to be assessed biblically. And I'm probably going to save a lot of time by doing it that way. And so what I think we might do is start with that first, and then I want to come back to the question of the setting of the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 concerning whether this group, as enunciated in the chapter, are in fact the friends of Gog or the enemies of Gog. Are they his friends or foes? Because this is, again, another matter of alternative explanation in the Brotherhood, where some, particularly those who favour the Arab controversy, have tended to read Ezekiel 38, that when Sheba and Dedan say, "Art thou come to take a spoil," that the implication is that in fact they will gladly join, partly because of their Arab hostility towards the people of Israel. So we're going to have a look at that question, and then in the course of that, as we've said, identify the question of whether they are the friends or the foes of Gog. I'm going to start by just drawing attention to the matter then of Tarshish as a nation in the biblical record. And one of the first things we note, which is probably helpful to identifying this power, because it's uniquely different to all the ones we've looked at so far, and that is that the Tarshish power is famous for its maritime ascendancy. It's known for its prowess in the matter of shipping. So when we come to the divine record, we find, for example, that the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 9 and verse 21 says, "Every 3 years once came the ships of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver." There's some debate as to whether that's ships to Tarshish or ships of Tarshish, but I think ships of Tarshish is a reasonable rendering. That's what the King James says. Again, in Isaiah 23, "Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in." Again, in Isaiah 60, "Surely the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to bring my sons from far." And lastly, in Ezekiel 27, "The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the seas." So clearly when we come to the matter of Tarshish, there's a unique smell of sea salt associated with this particular nation. We're to look to the waters rather than to the land. And that may in itself give us an indication that the particular location of Tarshish was perhaps either on an island or on the sea coast, since they were obviously associated with seafaring activities. So thus far so good. The problem is that there's quite a few views on who Tarshish is as well. Even within the Brotherhood, I've heard suggestions that Tarshish could be, that Tarshish was Carthage, which may have been a possibility in Old Testament times, that Tarshish was Spain, that Tarshish was Morocco, that Tarshish was Japan. I've heard that Tarshish is Japan. Not quite sure how you get to that one. It's quite an interesting long shot. Certainly the view that Tarshish is Britain, which is the more common biblical view amongst Christadelphians. So a fairly wide variety of interpretations as to who or what Tarshish could be. Yes. Yeah.
My grandfather's actually the Merchant of Tarshish. Tarshish is actually not a place, it's life, he says. Mm-hmm. And he has this theory about one of the stones in the wheels on the chariot, something or other. But anyway, I forget at the moment where his logic ran, but that the merchant of Tarshish was the merchant of life. Much like Lydia was the seller of purple, he kind of equated that, that the merchant wasn't from Tarshish, he was bringing something.
Well, that certainly sounds like an even longer shot than Japan. Look, I think by the time we come to our next slide, you'll be satisfied that there is something more definitive that we can apply to identifying it as a definite nation. But again, it's good to have a biblical evidence. In fact, one of the things about Bible study, one of the things about good Bible study, and one of the things about serious Bible study, is that good Bible scholars never pluck a verse at random out of the scriptures to suit their argument, and then build all of their thinking around that. That's what church ministers do. That's how church sermons are created. A church sermon is when a humanistic minister who pretends to masquerade under the guise of religionism, but in fact is either a modernist or a postmodernist, because he's thoroughly infected with seed of the serpent thinking, says, what will I preach to my congregation today? Decides on the subject he wants to talk about, and then finds a scriptural passage that will support what he wants to say. Bible scholars come to the Bible to say, what does Yahweh want to tell us? What does the Father want to teach us? What's the contextual power of the passage in terms of its didactic power to instruct us? And not only that, but not just that passage, but also this one, and 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 this one. And what a Bible scholar seeks to do is to take all of the Bible passages on a subject and to try and come up with something that harmonizes all of those so that they speak with the ring of authority, the one to the other. A Bible student never takes a verse in isolation and promulgates that if there are 15 other verses that disagree with that one. He's driven to the conviction that he must reconcile all 16 before he comes to an opinion. That's what good Bible scholarship's all about. Well, without dwelling too much on the lineal descendant relationships of our visiting brother from northern parts here, not the remotest parts of the north, but the point here is we've got to bring all the scriptures together, even for something like Tarshish. So let's just do that as an illustration, shall we? So what we've got here is an analysis from a biblical point of view. So who's Tarshish? And we're going to get a copy of the slide, so if I go at a speed that you can't quite manage, fear not. All shall be downloaded. Tarshish is a nation of Japhetic origin, Genesis chapter 10, verse 4. He was a son of Japheth. It's known as a single source of the metals silver, iron, tin, lead, Ezekiel 27, verse 12. Therefore, whichever nation qualifies, they've got to be able to dig up all four and have evidence that they've provided four. So a nation that's famous for silver doesn't qualify. Not unless they've got the others. These were all the metals of Tarshish. It's famous as a maritime power, Isaiah 2, verse 16. It's associated with trading activities in global markets, Ezekiel 27, 25. Any nation that fails the test of all four of those ingredients already misses the muster of whether they could be considered as a Tarshish power. Here's some more. Tarshish is a coastal or island power, Genesis 10. It's connected by commercial alliance to a family of strong lion nations, Ezekiel 38, verse 13, who are themselves independent coastal or island powers, Psalm 72, verse 10, inhabiting far-off maritime lands, Isaiah 66, verse 19. Any nation that fails the test of those four ingredients doesn't pass muster to be identified as Tarshish. Tarshish is a country to the remote west of Israel, Jonah 1:3, strongly associated with the Jewish people, Isaiah 69, having a God-respecting disposition, Isaiah 51, verse 5, but also allied to Arab nations in the Gulf region, Ezekiel 38, verse 13. When you actually put that as a grid over all the candidates, you'll find that Japan misses out fairly badly. maybe even the Wheel of Life does as well. Spain may have qualified on some counts in terms of its western direction, its coastal implications, even some of its metal ingredients, but it doesn't fit all the other qualifications. Nor does Carthage. So the reason why the Brotherhood over time has suggested that Britain is the best suggested fit for Tarshish is because, quite frankly, it's the best view that biblical scholarship will probably allow us to bring together. I don't know of any other nation that better qualifies all of the ingredients that the biblical record demands that Tarshish conform to. So the thing is, you need to go through and work all those through for yourself. There's a trick in there. There's a particular passage that you might want to think, I wonder how he got to that. You'll need to think about it, but I'm happy to stand by what I've put on that particular chart when you check it out when you get home. So we're going to jump the queue, really, and suggest that Tarshish is Britain, and that saves us a bit of identifying work later on in our workshop this afternoon. The next thing I wanted to mention in that regard was that if you come to the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 23, and because this is the chapter that really shows how Tarshish inherited its maritime position. Isaiah 23 starts by saying the burden of Tyre. Verse 1, howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no entering in, from the land of Kittim it is revealed to them. Be still, ye inhabitants of the isle, thou whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over the sea have replenished. Be thou ashamed, O Zidon, verse 4, for the sea hath spoken, even the sea, the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men, nor bring up virgins. So this particular chapter is about the impending overthrow of Tyre. Now, Tyre, of course, was a Phoenician power. They were a seafaring nation. They were sitting on the coast. In fact, verse 2 describes it as an isle, and so ultimately it was. Ultimately, Tyre was an island nation off the coast of the Mediterranean. But this prophecy speaks of the impending doom of Tyre. Verse 5, as at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. And then it says, verse 9, Yahweh of armies hath purposed it to stain the pride of all glory, to bring in contempt all the honourable of the earth. Pass through thy land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish, there is no more strength. He stretched out his hand over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. Yahweh hath given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. This is a prophecy of the impending overthrow of the Tyrian power. In fact, it's interesting that verse 15 goes on to say, it shall come to pass that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years shall Tyre sing as an harlot. Now what's interesting, of course, is that Tyre was overthrown by Nebuchadnezzar and was under Babylonian subjection for the 70 years of Babylonian supremacy mentioned elsewhere in Jeremiah 25:9. Do you remember how we're told that for 70 years Israel would suffer under the supremacy of Babylon? Well, Tyre also, and I think the 70 years is connected to that. The reason why that's interesting is if there is any latter-day application of Isaiah 23, you've got to try and puzzle how the 70 years might fit in, which leads to a revival, because it says in verse 15 that Tyre shall be forgotten, but after the end of 70 years, Tyre shall sing as an harlot. And really, it implies, again, she'll begin her trading activities again after this lull of 70 years. Now, I want to just draw attention to two things about this particular passage, because we're not going to investigate it in detail. But the first thing is to notice this, verse 6. Pass ye, that's Tyre, and all of her associated activities, pass ye over to Tarshish. Howl, ye inhabitants of the Isle of Tyre. Is this your joyous city, whose antiquity is of ancient days? Well, says the prophet, it is no longer. Her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. So just tracking that on a map, in fact, what we believe happened is historically the power of Tyre moved from Tyre to Carthage in terms of the sea trading supremacy of the nations. But from Carthage it moved to Venice, and from Venice to Britain, and to the maritime shipping industry that is now centred in the city of London. And London is still supreme in those maritime markets, even today. So there was a transfer of all of the trading activities from Tyre, whose feet took her afar off to sojourn in another place, which in fact was Tarsus or Tarshish. Now, I just want you to notice the key word in this chapter, because it's relevant to Ezekiel 38. Because Ezekiel 38 doesn't talk about the ships of Tarshish. It talks about the merchants of Tarshish. Now, I think that's the very thing that Tarshish inherited from Tyre. Because, incidentally, Tyre was never the superpower of its age, was it? The superpowers of the age were Babylon or Assyria to the north and Egypt to the south. They were the great military powers. Tyre was just a trading nation. Very efficient, very productive, but never a military superpower. And it wasn't Tyre's military capacity that got transferred to Tarshish. It was her merchant activities. Now, you see the key word? Verse 2. The merchants of Zidon. Verse 3. She is a mart of nations. Verse 8. Whose merchants are princes. Verse 11. Commandment against the merchant city. Verse 18. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness unto Yahweh. So you see that the key word that's used to describe the activities for which Tyre was famous is they were merchants, 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 merchants. They traded. And it's that activity that we believe passed from Tyre to Tarshish. And that now the phrase the ships of Tarshish captures all of that merchant trading activity for which Britain is in fact uniquely placed and famous even today in terms of that type of activity. The shipping exchanges of the world and the exchange of goods via that means is conducted principally through the London markets. So now let's just come on to the matter of Ezekiel 38, because I had a problem with my slide here that held me up, so just had a slight dislocation of the title, for which I apologise. But clearly what we notice when we come into the scriptures there's an alliance here at the time of the end, because there's Sheba and Dedan and all the merchants of Tarshish, but I think they're associated with Israel. We'll come back to that because that's our chapter for reference today. But here's another one. It's Psalm 72. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Who are they going to offer the gifts to? To the king of Israel. Psalm 72. Give the king thy judgments, O Lord, and thy righteousness under the king's son. It's a celebration psalm for the coronation of the king of Israel. Who do Tarshish and Seba bring their gifts to? The king of Israel. There is a Israel-Tarshish-Sheba alliance prophesied to come in the kingdom age in Psalm 72. Here's another one, Isaiah 60. All they from Sheba shall come, they shall bring gold and incense, and they shall show forth the praises of Yahweh, but also the isles shall wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first, to come unto the name of Yahweh thy God, and the glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee. So Sheba and Tarshish are both intimately associated with the nation of Israel in the kingdom age, says both Isaiah 60 and Psalm 72. But the reason why Ezekiel 38 is intensely interesting is Ezekiel 38, we believe, is set before the kingdom age. In fact, we believe, on the basis of our first study that said that Ezekiel 38 is not sequential, it's thematic, we believe that that setting of Ezekiel 38 is before the coming of Christ. So what we're being told, I think, prophetically in Ezekiel 38 is that we expect to see, we ought not be surprised to find an Israel-Tarshish-Sheba alliance developing at the time of the end. So connections between Israel and Britain, connections between Britain and Sheba, whoever Sheba is, which we're going to identify in our workshop, but also to complete the triangle, shall I say that again? Connections between Israel and Britain, between Britain and Sheba, and between Sheba and Israel. We expect to see a developing rapport between whoever the Sheba group of countries are and Israel as we come towards the controversy of Ezekiel 38. So come back to Ezekiel 38 now, and let's just have a look and see what it does say in terms of our question concerning whether they're friends or foes. When Gog comes down, this is what this particular group say in response. So it says, maybe going back to verse 11 for connection of Ezekiel 38, "And thou shalt say, I'll go up to the land of unwalled villages. I'll go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods and that dwell in the midst of the land." And when Gog does this, verse 13 says, "Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, O Gog, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil?" Now, it is interesting, isn't it? It doesn't say a lot about what they say, and I suppose that it's possible that we could read it two ways, that either they are reading this in the context of being the friends of Israel, or they're saying this in the context of being the foes of Israel. But we'd be best to come to a contextual solution, wouldn't we? So what do you think the contextual solution is? Well, just notice these things. Firstly, do you notice that when this group, the Sheba Tarshish group, make a response of any sort, the first thing they say is, "Art thou come?" Not, "Have you gone?" What's the difference? They're already there. Now, are they there to do battle? It would seem unusual to imagine Gog coming down to invade the land of Israel if there's already another group in there fighting. That would seem to be an unusual bringing together of circumstance, wouldn't it? That there's another group already there that say, "Hey, this is our battle, keep out." That doesn't sound to be the context, does it? The words read more as some form of surprised challenge, as if to say, "What are you doing here?" But the critical thing is, "Art thou come?" indicates that this group are already established in this area, and particularly are in association with Israel. So the second question is, what do you think they're there to do? Are they there to do battle or something else? Well, I think the context tells us. Because it's interesting that they say, well, it's not Tarshish that's there. It's the merchants of Tarshish. But that's that key word out of Isaiah 23. Well, why would the merchants of Tarshish be there? If Tarshish was there to do battle, it should be the guns and rockets of Tarshish, not the merchants. You don't send your traders in to do battle, although sometimes trading is like a battle. Now, I think this is a trading activity, isn't it? The phrase merchants of Tarshish indicates that Tarshish is busy doing what it knows what to do best, which is to set up trading deals. And so clearly the implication of that crucial word indicates that the Sheba, Dedan, Tarshish group are in the land already, in association, and they're actually busy trading. Now here's the next point of evidence to go with that. Do you notice that it says, to take away cattle and goods? The only other place where that phrase is used is in verse 12, when it talks about the people which are gathered out of the nations and which have gotten cattle and goods. Israel's gotten cattle and goods. Sheba and Dedan say, "Hey, have you come to take away cattle and goods?" The implication is they're already there trading in those things. That's what they're there doing. They're trading in cattle and goods and silver and gold. The very things that Gog comes down to try and seize control of, the Sheba Tarshish group are already actively engaged in trading in Israel in these very matters. Just a couple of things on the to sort of as an aside really to this, some of you which you may know, but there's actually a very strong commercial connection between what we might describe as the Sheba Dedan area, and I guess you're yet to discover or confirm where you think that is, but in the moderate Arab states there's a tremendously powerful connection between that area and the city of London. In fact, there are signed contractual agreements between the City of London and this trading bloc of the what I would describe as the Sheba nations. There's probably no stronger commercial connections anywhere in the world in this group apart from those that are already signed up with Britain. Britain, notice particularly, not so America. America's there, but the strongest commercial connections are Britain-orientated. Some of you will know the story that a few years ago, not too long ago, just probably, I think only about 3 or 4 years ago, there was an offer made to purchase 20% of the London Stock Exchange. The London Stock Exchange, with all of the august, you know, aura that goes with that, the London Stock Exchange. You know, this is the British. The British don't sell stuff that belongs to the Queen. About 20% of the stock exchange was up for sale anyway. They decided they needed to broaden their base or something. So the one of the American stock exchanges decided they'd make a bid. It wasn't the Dow Jones. What's the technology NASDAQ stock? The NASDAQ exchange said that we might actually make an offer for that 20%. The British said, no thank you. We don't want the Americans buying 20% of the London Stock Exchange. Who do you think you are? So then someone else came in and made a bid, not for 20%, but for 48%. And they said, all right then. And that was the Qatar Stock Exchange of Arabia. They sold 48% to them. Of course, if you think that Qatar is part of the Sheba group, you might think, well, that's quite interesting, really. Yes?
Do you mean 48% of the 20% or 40%?
48% of the entire London Stock Exchange.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite a serious piece of money and quite a serious connection. Right? So believe me, these two areas are really critically linked together economically and commercially. And I think the point is, well, that's to me what the prophecy said. Whether that had happened or not is incidental. You're excited when you hear something like that because you think this is prophecy fulfilling. But clearly this group are not there to do battle. They're there to trade. Now, here's the last thing that's interesting about that. Just one last feature is the word young lions thereof. That word young lion in the Hebrew is not a lion's whelp, like a little wee tiny cub. It's a lion that's strong enough to rend its own prey. So taking that from a symbolic point of view, if Britain is the mother lion, if Tarshish is represented as the mother lion here, then who might these other entities be? And the answer is, well, without going into detail, it doesn't matter. We're not going to try and start to say, well, it's these nations. The critical thing is they are independent nations, capable of standing on their own two feet, both commercially and militarily. They're young lions capable of rending their own prey to stay alive. Now, why is the phrase young lions interesting in the context, therefore, of Ezekiel 38? Well, I don't think the young lions are there to actually raven and devour the Israeli state. But clearly what the merchants of Tarshish and the Sheba Dedan group are saying is, look, to Gog, if you come down here, we're prepared to defend the relationships that we already enjoy in this area, and we're prepared to do battle on that. We're prepared to actually engage in controversy with you on this matter. I think that's the implication of the phrase, the young lions thereof, that it's those who make this comment. So contextually, I think that we would be fairly satisfied that the spirit of the Sheba Tarshish group in this particular prophecy is that they are thoroughly committed to a positive association with Israel. They're already present at the time of the Gogian invasion, and their response is not one of friendship to ally themselves to Gog. They are opposed to Gog and staunchly prepared to defend their own trading interests, which they're already busily engaged in at the time of the invasion. So that's all I really wanted to say about that. But again, it's interesting, isn't it, to work your way through what the passage appears to imply. And I think it's difficult to argue that this group, in fact, joyfully join with Gog so that they too can wreak vengeance on the Israeli state. That's, I don't think, how we would give a good, honest scholarly reading of Ezekiel 38 and verse 13. I think it's wishful thinking from those that are already committed to an Arab controversy idea, but it's not a biblically sound exposition of the verse.